This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and authors and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. And today I have the great pleasure of talking to Russell Banks. He's a writer. He's been an editor, a publisher, a lot of different things. How are you, Russell?
I'm fine. How are you, Dave?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Good.
So, you know, what I really wanted to talk to you about is kind of literary history that you've been involved in. You know, mostly going back, or at least starting with Lilla Bolero magazine, the period during which you were in North Carolina. And maybe you could, you know, just talk a little bit about how you got to North Carolina in the first place and what you were doing at that time.
Yeah, it was a roundabout route. I was in 1964, I was married. At a child, I was living in New Hampshire, working as a plumber and writing. I thought of myself as a writer, certainly at that time. But I had not been to college. I actually had been to Colgate University in 1958 for 6 weeks before dropping out and sort of hitting the road and had bounced around in the intervening 6 years, but had over the course of that 6 year period and decided that I was a writer, and that was what I was bending my life toward as much as I could. Anyhow, at that moment, that year, 64, my mother-in-law, my wife's mother, offered to pay for my college education if I would like to go. And I took advantage of that generous offer. And my wife was a Southerner from Richmond, Virginia. And she said, that's fine, but it has to be in the South. And so we looked South, and she wasn't all that happy to be in New Hampshire, I guess, at that time. And at that time, there really were only a couple of universities that had national reputations. Virginia and Duke and Chapel Hill were pretty much it. And Virginia and Duke were all male and all white. And Chapel Hill was coeducational and racially integrated. And it was it seemed like a much more cosmopolitan place, and a place that might have a room for someone like me who didn't fit the, you know, the template of your typical freshman student. So anyhow, I showed up there in fall of 64. And as it happened, there were a whole lot of other younger writers in graduate school there or in the neighborhood. It was a kind of a bohemian center and a politically hip and assertive place as well. So it attracted a lot of people from all over the country. So it was a very fertile and lively and intellectually and creatively stimulating place to end up. But it was almost by accident that I got there. I mean, I didn't plan it that way. And then, as it turned out, I mean, I fell in with a number of younger writers. Poet William Matthews was there at the time. Leon Rook, a novelist and story writer. Robert Morgan, a poet and novelist, and there were a dozen more who were present there then, and in, you know, one level or another, either graduate school or hanging on or hanging out or in my case, undergraduate as well. So that was kind of ground that we were standing on, and looking around and discovering not just ourselves as writers together, but also discovering a whole new American literature as it was starting to appear in the 60s, the middle 60s. San Francisco, New York, Boston, there was so much going on, and even in places like Minnesota, where Robert Bly was cranking out the 50s magazine and then the 60s magazine. San Francisco George Hitchcock was cranking out a Kayak magazine. And there were dozens more all over the country that were publishing writers who were most of them just a few years older than we and who were really kind of reinventing American poetry and American fiction at that time. And so it was very exciting to be aware of it and naturally wanting to participate in it. And so it wasn't a big step for those of us who were together in at Chapel Hill to say, why don't we participate? Why don't we make a magazine? We can make a magazine and start publishing, the same kind of work that's so exciting to us all over the country and bring it here to Chapel Hill. So that was really the kind of moment that that Little Bolero magazine, and then it became a press as well, came to life. And
so, but it was a group effort, wasn't it? I mean, more than it was several of you.
There were a small group. I mean, there was Newt Smith, a poet and critic, and he was a graduate student there at the time, a PhD student. Bill Matthews, William Matthews, and I, we were probably the central figures. And then there were a dozen more friends and classmates and so forth who gathered around us and participated in it and in the creation of the magazine. So it was a community, but also I think there was the fact that there were three or four of us who were learning from each other the way young writers do. You know, there's a period in every, it seems, every writer's, maybe every artist's life, but it's usually only a few years long, where you find your peers and you learn intensely and quickly from each other. And we were at that moment, and all of us, and we were able to generate a tremendous amount of energy and I think intelligence and experience coming together in a way that, you know, after a few years, you can't keep that going. I mean, you can only use it. It's a flame that eventually needs to go out and you have to move on. You can't work in a group forever as a writer, as an artist, but you can certainly take advantage of it in a period in your youth, as we did.
Yeah, no, it does seem that you were part of, I mean, I think that being part of a group, kind of the energy can feed off of one another to help start a magazine.
Yeah, and you know, it's also about reading too. You get six or eight people together who are really smart readers and adventurous readers, and they're all going in slightly different directions, going out into the world. And you know, someone might be reading Vallejo, someone else might be reading. I remember a whole bunch of guys were very serious about writers that were coming out of San Francisco, like Lew Welsh and people who are acolytes of Gary Snyder and so forth, and writers that you might not normally see or whose work you might know, Michael Rumaker, people like that. And I remember just, you know, someone saying, you've got to read this. This is fantastic. And I would never have probably found it on my own. So there is this very useful kind of feeding frenzy that I think young writers, young artists get into together for a period that where they're all just devouring the world as fast as they can, and everybody's going in slightly different directions, but at the same time overlapping and teaching in a way that you can't function. You can't do that in a classroom. I'm not even sure you can do it in a graduate writing program. You kind of need freewheeling, free associating, recklessness that that the Academy itself doesn't necessarily encourage.
Well, that's true. And I think you hit on something really interesting, too, and that is the kind of fertility of talking about different kinds of people, different writers' enthusiasms kind of cross-fertilizing between, you know, the people in that group.
I mean, it's important to note, too, that this was not an MFA program at Chapel Hill, you know. There were people there who were getting degrees in anthropology or in linguistics or, you know, literature or classics and so forth. We weren't taking creative writing workshops, and we weren't studying for a master's degree in creative writing. So there was a kind of recklessness and appetite in a way and freedom that and I don't think would have been there had it been like Iowa or in those days there were only a half a dozen at most of creative writing workshops, Iowa and Johns Hopkins and Columbia and one or two others. But I think that the kind of curriculum that MFA programs tend to generate and impose would not have served our purposes as well as what we were generating ourselves and for each other, through each other.
So how did, this is sort of getting into the weeds a little bit, but how did you finance Lilla Bolero at that stage?
Yeah. Oh, well, we find it like bake sales. I mean, any old way, raffles. We hit up our faculty members at the university. We hit up our friends, our parents, any old way we could. And then there was a tremendous amount of volunteer labor. And we printed it on a multi-lift press that was at the sort of the political headquarters of Chapel Hill at the university at the YMCA. And they had an old multi-lift press, and we taught ourselves how to use it. Newt Smith and Bill Matthews and I, and we got free use of that and free paper if we agreed to print up all the pamphlets, leaflets, posters, et cetera, for all the radical political groups that were organizing around at the same time in the same place. So it was really, it was just, you know, hit and miss. And people were generous, and they admired and liked what we were up to, and we were able to scratch along. And then one thing happened, I think it was in the third issue, we discovered, I think maybe one of us, David Mallison, who was working with us on the magazine at the time, was a graduate student also. David uncovered a 1933 short story published in a literary magazine at Chapel Hill by William Faulkner, had never been collected. Wow. And it had just appeared in an edition of maybe 300 in a magazine in Chapel Hill. I have no idea how it got there. But I wrote to Malcolm Cowley, who was the great Faulkner scholar at that time and had put out not too long before that the Portable Faulkner. You may remember that volume. Yep. And he was the Faulkner man. He was at Yale, and I wrote him, told him we had this story. Oh, we also had some poems of Faulkner's too, and would he write a commentary on it? And he jumped in and happily did. And as a result of that, we ended up with library subscriptions all across the country, which gave us our base in a way, our financial and circulation base. Suddenly we had something like 350 subscribers, which was enough to finance the printing and the future issues as we went along. In those days, you know, libraries had pretty good budgets, and then university libraries, academic libraries, and they happily subscribed to a magazine they had never heard of if it had something by Faulkner in it. And so suddenly we were up and running. And I think that was the third issue of the magazine.
Yeah, that's a pretty nice serendipity to have happen, I think.
Yeah, I know. It was.
And how many issues of Lilla Bolero were published altogether?
I think in the end we published 15. But also a number of books and pamphlets. We started a pamphlet series, poetry pamphlets, and then fiction pamphlets, where we published a short story, and then individual books and poems. Not too many, but enough so that we felt we were a real publisher, and I think we were. We were mixing and matching a lot of different kinds of writers. Older, from the older generation of people who were like Robert Bly, Robert Creeley, James Wright, and then a whole bunch of younger writers who are our generation, poets and writers like James Tate and Charles Simic, and so on. And so it was a nice mix, and an unusual mix really for that time, for that moment. And I think that it made the magazine, really readable and of value to an awful my whole generation, really. And I still run into people who say, boy, I remember those Lilla Boleros. We used to wait for them and then argue about them and talk about them when they came in. So
no,
I remember
them too. I think I'm a little bit younger than you, but it was the same experience for me of magazines being the place where I discovered the breadth of writing that existed. And Lilla Bolero was one of the ones that I remember. I also remember the pamphlets because, I think that they were inexpensive, which was good.
Yeah, that's right. No, I think that's true. The magazines in that era really made you feel as though you were part of a community. And you might not agree with everything that every other magazine was doing, but there was enough going on there that you felt tied to it. I mean, I remember Clayton Eshelman's Caterpillar magazine. It was overlapped there. There was El Corno Emplumado coming out of Mexico City back then, too.
Right. Margaret Randall.
There was overlap there. Margaret Randall's magazine. And so there was this overlap, that made you feel like you were part of a really intense and imaginative and in literary terms, significant community that was coming into its own, maturity right in front of our eyes.
Yeah, it was like a giant wave of people and so many different kinds of writers. You remember Dust Books out in California.
Oh, yeah.
Len Fulton, who had the directory, trying to keep track of everything that was going on.
I know.
It was a pretty amazing.
But it was an interesting kind of moment, too, because it was more personalized, I think, in many ways than and today with the internet and the digitalization of publications, there was something kind of funky and down home about it. These magazines, so many of them were coming out of the Lower East Side, New York or San Francisco or almost everywhere across the country eventually. But they were like, artisanal in a sense. Yeah. I mean, they were many of them were just cranked out on mimeograph machines, or in our case, like little multi-width press. And there was a kind of a hands-on, handmade quality to them that, some of them were pretty ugly too. I mean, they weren't very attractive, some of them, but they had a feel of a human being operating there, living and reading and writing and distributing the work that I felt happy to be a part of at that time, and it seemed in a way. More communal, more familial almost than it does today.
Well, there, it is true that the hands-on self-teaching, where mm-hmm. you could see all the mistakes that people were making and all the things they were learning, mm-hmm. a lot of the magazines were just physically, as you said, not very attractive. But then people would mm-hmm. learn how to do them better, and they would begin to master the technology a little bit, and whatever they were doing. It's sort of like underground newspapers, where at the same time, just all over the country.
Right. No, you're quite right. That's a good parallel, and you could see people learning as they go and growing as they go. And that was fun and lively.
So just, to kind of continue with the historical part of Lilla Bolero, you kept on doing it after you were done in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, I left Bill Matthews and I more or less kept it going between us. I left in 68 and went back to New Hampshire, where I started to teach and was living up there with my family. And Bill got a job teaching in Ithaca, New York, at Cornell, and he ended up there. And so, but we did it long distance. I ran the printing and most of the the hands-on editorial work out of my home in New Hampshire. And Bill did most of the editing, correspondence, and so forth that involved poetry, particularly from Ithaca. And then three or four times a year, we would try to pull everything together and make an issue out of it. It worked. It was hard work. It was difficult because we were, far apart. But Bill and I were both, we were so personally so close, and both of us, writing letters almost daily back and forth. This was before email, so they were real letters, and kind of governing what we were doing that way, and coordinating what we were doing that way, and then we would go back and forth to each other's homes, and still we were very close, even though we were physically kind of separated. We still managed to keep the thing going, and almost as if we were living in the same town still. That was good. It was hard. It was good work. And I was, always kind of amazed that we managed to keep doing it after we left Chapel Hill.
And how long did it continue before it eventually ended?
Around 1974, I think, was when we finished. So it was a decade altogether. That's a good lifespan, I think, for any literary project. I think magazines that go on beyond that period tend to start imitating themselves, and before you know it, they're boring, and nobody wants to read them, and it seems as though nobody wants to write for them either. And same thing with small presses. I think they have a built-in life expectancy where the energy is strong and the commitment is strong, and it hasn't become an institution, and it still has that vitality. But after about 10 years, I think it's very difficult to keep it going.
Yeah.
No, especially if the editors are people like Bill and me. And I mean, we were writers first, and after a while you say, am I an editor? Am I a writer? You end up with that quandary and that conflict too.
So are of the writers that you published, and I know there are quite a few and many who are still writing, but which ones would you say, and I'm not trying to get you to say which ones you like the best, but which ones did you discover through being the editor or the publisher of the magazine and the books?
Yeah, well, there were, an awful lot. Poets in particular were easy to discover because you weren't competing with mass market magazines or magazines that paid big money. And so I would say, a dozen poets or so that if you pick up any anthology today and you look, from Steve Dunn to Louise Gluck to Simic to get down the list, and they were young writers. We were just beginning to publish, and we were happy to find space for them in Little Bolero. And in fiction, it was similar too. We were publishing a number of writers who later became part, and I became associated with through the Fiction Collective, which was a publishing venture I got involved with in the late 70s. It involved people like Ronald Sukenik and Mark Mirsky and a number of others who were in different parts of the country. And so we were publishing them in the pages of Little Bolero also. Steve Katz, writer from Colorado. And so I wouldn't say we were out to discover the next generation of writers so much as we were out to publish work that seemed to otherwise have difficulty finding an outlet. And that was, we felt, quality work. And Clarence Major, he was publishing a lot of fiction back then, I remember.
Yeah, there were a lot of writers in Little Bolero that I remember also from the Fiction Collective, which was a fantastic, fantastic operation. Maybe it hasn't been recognized enough for what it did, I think.
Yeah, it was. It is kind of radical, too, in its initial conception, where it was really was meant to be a kind of experiment and writers functioning as editors and publishers together. Everyone who published a book with the Fiction Collective also had to work as an editor and had to help publish other people's books as well. You couldn't just sort of send your book off and say, please publish my book, and then say, thank you very much, and that's the end of the relationship. It really was a kind of joint effort by the writers themselves, and it worked for quite a while. Again, it was that kind of 10-year expectancy, and it worked despite the fact that we were publishing books that were strictly, severely non-commercial, but were necessary and good and important books that were being written at that time. But there was no commercial market for it, but there was a literary market for it. It was parallel in some ways to the publishing of poetry.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I think experimental fiction has always been challenged, in that way.
Yeah, as it was called. I always hated calling it experimental fiction, as if it was taking place in a laboratory. Or even innovative fiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But there,
but I don't know what else. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, but I don't like the term.
Right. But it's hard to figure out. It's hard to figure out what else to call it.
I guess so. It was fiction, though, that was challenging the conventions of narrative and of realism by and large, and challenging it in all kinds of ways. Sometimes in very formalistic and some in abstract ways, and sometimes linguistically challenging the conventions and sometimes just the visual, the orthography, the layout on the page, challenging the conventions of that too. So it was good and useful, and I think it was a valuable kind of adventure. And I'm very happy that it's still going on. And I know that the people who are operating it managed to keep it going year after year. It's a fresh group each couple of years. There seem to be a new bunch of editors and people taking it over and running it. But it's kind of amazing they can keep it going so long.
Well, that's, I think, what you hit on earlier is you have to reinvent the group and they kind of continually make it new.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's true. And they have done that. The Fiction Collective has done that. I don't even know anybody who's currently operating the Fiction Collective. In the beginning, the first 10 years or so, I knew everybody. We all work together, but I don't know anyone now who does it.
Well, that's sort of part of the story too. Part of the narrative is the way that writing. There's this sort of generational change over time, and people get grouped based on where they come from in a way, but that's not necessarily accurate.
That's right. That's true. It does happen, and you evolve and change, and it goes back to what I started out saying. When you're young at a certain point in your life, it's very helpful and it's very inspiring to work as a group, to surround yourself with like-minded friends and learn from them and work together. But you, at some point, you've got to break away from that group and evolve in such a way that you're alone. And you're going to spend the rest of your writing life really outside the group. Occasionally, writers make a mistake and they over-identify with the group and they stay attached to the group. And before you know it, the limitations of a group. You know, you could see it with some of the Black Mountain writers. You could see it with some of the Beat writers. And so on, where the group identity carried them and they attached themselves to it too long and their work didn't evolve and they didn't make that move into solitude that I think you have to make eventually if you're going to write for a lifetime. You really can't stay surrounded by your like-minded friends, peers, and so on. You have to go off and sit on the mountain by yourself.
Yeah. No, in a way, you just made me think of something really interesting, or at least it is to me, that you see this in music sometimes where a band will get stuck repeating itself because of the popularity. And so when you were talking about the Beats and the Black Mountain writers, partially they were forced into that groupness by the historicity and it made it harder for them to make changes that it's almost like the audience wouldn't let them.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and the relationships that they had when they were young become controlling rather than ways and means for growth and allegiances. You end up defending and feeling and being having allegiances to a kind of writing rather than to individual writers or individual works. And that's the death knell, I think, for almost any writer, where you're defending a kind of writing. And that's dangerous.
Yeah, no, and I think there are writers who have felt that they had to force their way out of that sense of group identity in order to be themselves and to not be labeled and constrained by style that was not really inherent to them. It was just part of something that they were doing.
No, I've faced a lot of that myself in a way, because going back to what we were saying about the Fiction Collective and my involvement with that project and early work that I published in the 60s and 70s, where I evolved over time, my work evolved over time and changed and didn't change in a radical way, but it certainly, I like to think that it grew and matured and became larger over time. But oftentimes I find that someone has read me wrongly because they read into it the history of work that I did back in the 60s and 70s and don't track the progression, as I think of it, at least.
Well, that's probably something that many, I mean, you've been writing for a long time, and I'd imagine I'm thinking about this just in terms of some writers who I've been reading recently, that their early work is so different from what they did in their middle years and later years, that if you just read the first book or two, you wouldn't know, it would be a different person.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's good that it keeps moving. If I think the hardest thing, you know, is I've gotten older now. I'm in my now late 70s. The hardest thing for me as a writer now is to not know what I'm doing. In the same way, when I was very young in my 20s, I didn't know what I was doing. The real problem with growing older as a writer in some ways is that you begin to know too well what you're doing, and you've got to constantly stir it up and move and keep moving into some place where you really don't know what you're doing. And that gets harder and harder as you get older. It was very easy when I was in my 20s. I hadn't a clue what I was doing. But now, in my 70s, after having been doing this for over 50 years, I find it harder to get that state of confusion and insecurity and recklessness that I had back then.
Right. Well, maybe there is, if you can find a way to meld what you know and what you don't know, that might be the trick, you know?
Yeah, right.
That, if you learn how to do that, you could probably teach all older writers something really special.
Yeah. Well, we all need that. I think, though, the most important thing for me is not to plow the same field, but to constantly find a new field and to cut into and plow and. You know, that's very exciting. I mean, it keeps me alive and moving. If I had to repeat myself, I think I would just, I wouldn't. I would shrivel up and die. I would simply not bother.
Well, it sounds to me like it's not in your nature to do that.
No.
So.
No.
So.
Not at all.
Just what, you know, one last question, because I know, I'm sure you're busy, but have you ever... written about Bill Matthews? And, you know, I knew him when I was young. I think I took classes from him at some point, and I really liked him a lot, but I didn't feel like I knew him very well.
You know, I never have, and I should at some point. There are those of us who knew Bill really well for many years and who loved him. And it would be worth doing, really. I spent some time this over the holidays here with Dan Halpern, who's my publisher, old friend, and was one of the closest friends that Bill had too, for going back to the 60s. And we sat around, Dan and I, over the Christmas holiday, reminiscing and talking about Bill, telling Bill Matthews stories. And there are so many. He was a brilliant man and a great conversationalist. And a witty, funny man, and you know, profoundly educated too. I mean, he could move rapidly in many different directions and at many different depths. And he was an important person to a number of us. And he died way too soon. And every now and then I think, yeah, someone should write a serious memoir about Bill and pull it back up. You know, he's right now, his work is not as known as it probably will be again, and certainly as it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Writers go through those periods where they're behind the clouds or on the dark side of the moon, and then they reappear on the other side in the light again. And so I think he'll have that kind of moment yet again. But right now he is sort of on the dark side of the moon, which is wrong and unfortunate, because his work was wonderful. But as a personality, as a person, and yeah, teacher. He was great.
Yeah, I agree. Well, maybe this will encourage you to write something about Bill, because I think that would be, I think you're the right person to do it.
Well, we met at a very crucial moment in our lives. He was in his early 20s. I was in my early 20s. We both had married too soon. We had kids. And here we were in a university situation, just beginning our lives as writers. And we stayed close right up to the day he died. There are very few relationships like that that start early and last long.
That is true. Mm. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Russell. It's been a great pleasure for me. And
great, David.
Thank you again. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and authors and the publishing industry.